So the Supreme Court has not clarified what kind of conduct, if any, though, would merit a waiver by conduct exception. But the First Court of Appeals has. They previously recognized that in TSU versus State Street Bank, in which the university agreed by contract to lease equipment from a corporation, and that and the university included a letter with the lease assuring the corporation that TSU would be obligated to pay any judgment. But after the equipment was delivered and TSU declared the lease void and unenforceable and claimed immunity. So the First Court in that case found that the government officials convinced the corporation to enter into the lease with false promises that the contract was valid and enforceable, which fit the waiver by conduct exception that the Supreme Court had alluded might be out there. So the Supreme Court has recognized a variation on waiver by conduct exception in Riata Construction when a governmental entity voluntarily initiates a lawsuit. And this is not only for affirmative litigation, but also if the governmental entity asserts affirmative claims for monetary damages. So here the First Court found that the waiver by conduct occurred because the Water Supply District procured the filing of the condemnation proceeding based on the negotiations with the pipeline company's counsel. Further, the district did initiate the judicial portion of the condemnation proceeding by objecting after the administrative proceeding concluded. And finally, the district went beyond seeking recovery of additional compensation by also requesting damages for the alleged breach by the pipeline companies of the right of entry agreement. So for those reasons, the First Court held again that the Water Supply District waived its sovereign immunity by conduct. So this case was decided in April. It'll be interesting to see if it's appealed to the Supreme Court. So now comes one that's near and dear to my heart. If you ever want to talk about ERCOT sovereign immunity over a beer, just call me up. I'm sure, you know, we'll never forget Winter Storm Uri. There have been a lot of lawsuits that came out of that storm. A lot of them still going on, as I'm sure you all know. So one question we all have now that everyone's heard of ERCOT, is whether ERCOT is entitled to sovereign immunity. ERCOT's not a state agency. It's a nonprofit organization with quasi-governmental responsibilities. So there are two cases, really, that are considering this. But for our purposes, this case came out of the Fifth Court of Appeals in Dallas, which held in a second case that ERCOT is not entitled to sovereign immunity. So the case has a very long road, and it's not over yet. But a little background on ERCOT. The Public Utility Regulatory Act requires the Public Utility Commission to certify an independent organization to perform certain functions, including ensuring the reliability and adequacy of the grid. So in 2001, the PUC certified ERCOT as that independent organization. I mentioned that ERCOT's a nonprofit. They're a 501c4. ERCOT's bylaws define which types of entities can be ERCOT members. Each member has voting rights. They pay annual dues. ERCOT's managed by a CEO and a board. And with limited exceptions, meetings of ERCOT's board and subcommittees must be open to the public. So also, the Public Utility Regulatory Act requires the PUC to adopt and enforce rules related to the reliability of the grid. But PURA allows the PUC to delegate that responsibility to the independent organization, which it has done. So ERCOT's bylaws and protocols, which is how their rules are referred to, must be approved by the PUC. Finally, of importance is that ERCOT is required to submit its annual proposed budget to the PUC for approval or modification. And after approving the budget, the PUC authorizes ERCOT to charge wholesale buyers and sellers a system administration fee to fund their budget. So this case really arose out of a merchant power producer, Panda Power. Under the PUC's rules, ERCOT's required to publish a resource adequacy report, which ERCOT calls the Capacity Demand and Reserves Report, CDR, at least annually. They publish it twice a year. To generate and transmit sufficient, to determine the region's ability to generate and transmit sufficient electricity to meet projected demands. So generators and transmission utilities rely on those CDR reports to a certain extent when deciding whether to invest in new plants or new transmission. Plaintiff alleges that ERCOT's CDR reports in 2011 and 2012 negligently and fraudulently projected serious and long-term scarcity of power supply. So Panda relied on that information to build new power generation, and they spent over $2 billion doing that. After Panda began the construction, though, ERCOT revised its forecasts and instead projected an excess of generation capacity rather than a shortfall. So Panda claims that had what ERCOT initially represented been true, they would have sold their power for much more. So Panda filed suit. ERCOT filed two pleas to the jurisdiction at the district court level for dismissal, one of which on the grounds of sovereign immunity, which the district court denied. So on appeal to the Fifth Court, the first time, which they call Panda 1, the Court of Appeals determined that ERCOT's actions were protected by immunity and instructed the district court to dismiss the case for lack of jurisdiction. So the district court did, but then this appeal followed for on-bank review. And just a quick refresher on-bank review, that's appropriate based on the law of the case doctrine, which mandates that the ruling of an appellate court on a question of law is the law of the case in all subsequent proceedings unless clearly erroneous.